I smile every single time I hear those voices. They're just a few of the 8 voices that we and our guests work to highlight and create greater understanding about here on Talking Apes. With 2022 coming to an end, from everyone at Talking Apes and from our parent organization, Nonprofit Globio, I would just like to say an enormous thank you to all of our listeners and our loyal supporters. Our growth has been incredible this past year, and it's all because of you. And the lineup of guests coming in 2023 is absolutely amazing. I am so looking forward to some of these upcoming conversations. Award-winning writers like David Quammen and Carl Safina, as well as a host of remarkable researchers, vets, and conservationists. You won't want to miss a single episode. If you haven't already, please consider supporting Talking Apes by first sharing our podcast with friends and family. And if you're in a position to do so, please consider supporting us with your tax-deductible donation on our website at talkingapes.org or by becoming a valued Patreon subscriber, where you'll have access to special features, sneak previews, and behind-the-scenes interviews, as well as the warmest digital hugs and thank yous from our entire team here at Talking Apes. And remember, Talking Apes is part of Nonprofit Globio's Education, Outreach, and Media program. If you'd like to discover more, you can do so by finding links to everything on our website at talkingapes.org.
My name is Eric Kane, and today we have something a little different in store for you. The regular host of the show, as you may know, is Jerry Ellis. I am going to talk a little bit with Jerry about who he is, where he came from, how he got on to this path, how he wound up spending so much time, so much of his focus on great apes, and where we go from here. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce my friend, Jerry Ellis.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for being on my podcast.
So far, I'm really enjoying it.
This will be kind of interesting to have the tables turned and to be on the other microphone, I guess, as it were.
Now, you and I have known each other for quite a while now. I should interject here that we're both sitting here in Portland, Oregon, in the United States, where we both live. I was a longtime public television documentary producer. And actually, at one point, made a story or two about Jerry way back when. There's a lot I still do not know about Jerry and his interest in apes. And so if you want to get rolling here.
Yeah, let's dig in and see where we get.
Now, you have a YouTube channel called Apes Like Us, and you've created this regular podcast called Talking Apes. The obvious first questions to ask are, why do you think apes like us, and do apes really talk?
Well, apes like us talk, and that maybe is part of the reason that we started both of those channels as part of the nonprofit that we launched 20 years ago called Globio, and I know we'll probably get into that at some point in the conversation, but we are an ape, and we connect to apes, right? They look like us. So that hurdle of connecting us to other species, we can make quickly because they look like us. They, you know, they have hands, they have 2 eyes in front of their face and stuff. Apes Like Us and Talking Apes became outreach programs of that nonprofit Globio, partly because people didn't know that we were apes and that we kept trying to find ways to illustrate that and talk about that. And it just, we couldn't. And so the next thing we knew, we were creating vehicles like Talking Apes to explain to people that we are apes and we talk, and we should be talking about all the other apes on this planet, which are bonobos, gorillas, chimpanzees, and orangutans. So yeah, we're one of the 5 great apes. We talk, they talk, but you know, they use a vocabulary and methods of communicating that we don't, but that's what we try to explore. So people become aware of that and aware that there are other apes on this planet and they're important.
What's the difference between apes and monkeys?
Apes, basically, we have no tails. That's the primary piece of it. Monkeys, if you see any primate that has a tail, whether it's prehensile, which means it can grab onto things. If you're not familiar with that word prehensile, think about an elephant's trunk, how it can wrap it around things and pull up on things. And that's a prehensile trunk. But there are monkeys in the New World, which is South America primarily and Central America. They have prehensile tails, so they can grab. And monkeys in the Old World, which is Africa, India, Indonesia, they have just tails that hang straight down. And so, but tails are probably the most distinctive feature between monkeys and apes. There are things like teeth construction and other things that you could look at too. But, you know, if you walk into your local zoo and you're looking at an enclosure with some primate in it, the very first thing you can say is, does it have a tail or not have a tail? And that will be a big clue as to whether it's an ape or a monkey.
You know, I had not thought about this before, but here in the U.S., I know long ago, Ice Age mammals walked this ground. Mammoths, sloths, different sort of horse-looking things. And way before them, we had dinosaurs here. I've never seen fossilized ape skeletons in this country. Do they only live in faraway lands overseas, Africa, other places far from here? Or did they once inhabit this place?
Well, the short answer to that is no. There were never any apes in North America. We've never found any fossils of apes. In fact, we've never found any fossils of monkeys, like modern day monkeys in North America. And the reason is because North America split off from the other continents long before monkeys and apes had evolved as a group. And so it was isolated and didn't have any of those beginnings. Now, some people will ask, well, South America has monkeys. True. But South America split off at a much later time from Africa. And so it carried with it some of the early monkey type creatures. But it didn't even carry with it apes. So we've never found any fossils of apes there either.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Where did you grow up? How did you wind up on this path?
I loved nature from as far back as I can possibly remember, and everything was fascinating to me. I grew up near Seattle, Washington, and we lived just south of there, and there was a shopping mall near Tacoma, Washington, which had a gorilla in the shopping mall. And the owner, this was in the early 60s, 1960s, and no one thought twice about having exotic animals in really strange places. You didn't just go to a zoo, but you'd see them, you know, in roadside menageries and circuses and, you know, all kinds of places. And this owner of the shopping mall had exotic animals at the shopping mall to lure people in to come, basically like a little, you know, little zoo, and it would lure people in to there and they would do shopping. So if you can imagine a big shopping mall with, you know, different kinds of stores, but part of it scattered throughout were these animals. And in one of those enclosures, which was not big at all, it was, you know, maybe only very small, few meters by few meters, or 6 feet by 6 feet, let's say. And there was a gorilla in there, a Western lowland gorilla, the kind of gorilla that most people would be familiar with in a zoo today. And I remember sitting on the opposite side of the glass. I was about 8 years old at the time, and I just was so eternally fascinated by this animal and why it was there. And I remember as a little kid, just like there's a pane of glass and it's sitting opposite. And I, to this day, I can visualize that. And that was my first encounter with, you know, a great ape. And it turned out over time, there ended up being a couple of chimpanzees there. That great ape had had a little female that had also been bought, but she had died pretty quickly, which was common. These things were poached out of the wild, and then they were put up They were sold off. People bought them like that. And that was not unusual. Most zoos at the time got their primate species, most of their species, from these, what we now call poachers, who went into the wilds and would get them. So this one probably came from somewhere in the Congo Basin and ended up in this place far in the Western Hemisphere where it was cold and in a shopping mall. That was unsettling to me, but it also awakened in me this idea that there were these incredible species that were somewhere else on our planet. And I was just curious to go explore them. And from a little, the time I was a small kid, I used to run away from school and the first recess in the mornings, I would take off from school and just leave because I wanted to go out into woodlots behind the school and just find birds and, nature. So it's always been fascinating to me. And that was the beginning, that fascination and curiosity about nature.
This reminds me of one of my early experiences with you hiking in the Columbia River Gorge here in Oregon. A beautiful trail up in the hills, looking down on the Columbia River, magnificent view in every direction, just beautiful panoramic scenery. And you came up behind me and you were looking at stuff on the ground. You're looking at little bugs crawling around and you were taking pictures of tiny little flowers you saw down there. And there was some rotting wood with something growing out of it. And I said, well, look at this view. And you just you were indifferent. You said, but look at this stuff down here. And that really changed the way I experienced walks in the woods. I mean, you were looking at all this little stuff down on the ground and not paying a whole lot of attention to the big, spectacular panorama.
I've always been interested in the little things, not just in size, but in importance. We look at those tiny things and think of them as insignificant, but yet we know they're hugely, hugely significant in the overall scheme of things. We love the grandiose. As humans, we love that giant scenery. If we think about the first national parks in the United States, they were all around grandiose landscapes. The Tetons, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, Yosemite, they were all these places that had massive, massive landscapes, which, those typically white men at the time in the mid-1800s could go and stand there. And, I've read a lot of reasons why, but they were a sense of power, this big landscape. It wasn't until almost 100 years later after our first national park that we created a national park in the Florida Everglades around biodiversity, and which is, it's a mucky, swampy place, but it's the little things. And so those have always mattered to me because it's that little stuff that connects everything. It connects us to the land. It connects us to all the fibers of what a place really is. And so, when you had that experience with me, we were filming that piece on the rainforests here, and the rainforests are more than just their giant trees. They are, I remember one of the scientists that I was working with, he was talking about these giant trees. They're actually a network, think of it as an apartment building, of 1,000 to 1,200 different species that could live in the ground around its roots all the way to the top of its tree. Now, we think about maybe an eagle's nest in the very top of the tree, but there are squirrels, there are funguses, there are bacteria, there's all of this stuff. There's little mites, there's ants crawling up and down the tree. There's just creatures on every scale that make that up. You have to think of it as more than just its bored feet and the timber that's there. You have to think of it as this complexity. And are you willing to, throw that all away for the bored feet that you can get? Or is there an alternate way in which you can get that same thing that you're seeking in resources? So the little things help me see the big landscape more clearly.
How did you first start to interact with wildlife in a way that led to your becoming a wildlife photographer?
like I said, I've always had this fascination with nature and wildlife. And so I assumed I wanted a career somehow in it. And science was the only pathway that I knew about growing up. And so I thought, well, I will study hard. I'll go to college. I'll study the sciences. And so I thought I was going to be, I wanted to do coral reef ecology. I wanted to study coral reefs. And I thought I'd end up on some tropical island in the South Pacific for the rest of my existence and be studying, you know, fishes and species on coral reefs. And so I took classes to become a marine biologist and do all that. And it was during that process that I actually started photographing through microscopes. So cameras were just a vehicle to explore the world. You know, like I said, I was really curious. And what I found is the things that I photographed through a microscope were really, it was interesting to be able to stop and really look at it. In that process, somebody handed me an underwater camera, one of the early Nikons called a Nikonos. And so I was scuba diving as part of studying marine biology. And I would go out and I would take pictures of things underwater. And it was a crazy process back then because it wasn't sophisticated like it is now. I mean, you loaded these cameras and you took it underwater and hoped it didn't leak and you got it all sealed properly and had crazy little flash bulbs that would go off and sometimes they wouldn't go off. But if you were lucky, you came back with some pictures of unusual creatures that a lot of us, I think, now kind of take for granted, you know, weird and colorful starfish and things like that. But I'd come back with them. And at that point, and this is early 1970s, mid 1970s, I guess, they were really novel. We didn't have all of the, you know, nature channels on television. We weren't streaming tons of nature. There wasn't a David Attenborough who created all these amazing nature pieces for the BBC. And so the only underwater work that you ever saw was maybe once or twice a year in something like National Geographic or one of the magazine like it. So people would see these pictures I took and they were just like, oh my God, what is that? And they get all excited. And I go, well, it's a starfish. You know, or something more elaborate. Maybe it's a crinoid or, you know, that kind of thing, you know, feather star or something. I realized that was kind of an initial turning point for me because I realized this was a way to communicate to people. The magic that I saw out there and that, you know, had become part of my life and what I was so curious about through imagery, you could introduce it to other people who would never end up underwater perhaps. And that became more interesting than dissecting things and, you know, distilling things in a lab. And so my interest drifted away from that sort of hardline science to something that was more incorporating a look at natural history and behavior and then how to illustrate that so that you could communicate it to others and get them excited about the world we live in.
Well, that's pretty sophisticated motivation.
I was in my final year at university and I decided to quit. I never finished university, which drove my professors up a wall because I was already planning to go off to Australia to go to graduate school to do coral reef ecology on the Great Barrier Reef, my hope, which was kind of strange because a few years later I would end up in Australia and Papua New Guinea living and filming and photographing as a photographer and doing books on natural history and parks and wildlife and things like that. So it was kind of strange that Australia would come into the picture in a few years. But it was really that. In fact, in the beginning, there was a grad student in the lab, and she's the one who encouraged me to get some of that early work published. And I was like, no. You know, she sort of kept pushing. So I sent 5 pictures off to a magazine. And then one day at my folks' house, their check shows up for $125 and from a company I don't know. And I said, I was afraid to cash it because I thought they made a tragic mistake. And I finally called them. They were in Florida and this woman said, well, I don't know. Let me look this up. And she looked it up. She came back. Well, she said, did you send us some work to be published, a manuscript or something? And I said, well, I sent this magazine, but she said, well, that's one of our magazines we publish. And she said, so that's your payment for, we use the pictures and we'll be sending you copies. And so I got paid $25 each for each of these pictures that they published, which I now know was a lot cheaper than I should have been doing. But I went, wow, you take pictures, you send them to people, they give you money. and you could actually make a living doing this. I mean, it was $125. And so I thought, oh, you know, I'll be a photographer.
You became a photographer with a science background, having previously been a budding scientist that took pictures.
Yeah, I would not have called myself a photographer at that point. I was still somebody who was just taking pictures. There were several catalytic events along the next 5 to 6, 7 years. Where I became a photographer is moving to Australia and to do a project with a couple of scientists. They wanted to write some magazine articles and things about wildlife in Australia, and they needed somebody to take the pictures. And so I spent the next several years just traveling the entire country of Australia with support from the Australian Tourist Commission and Qantas Airlines and some others to afford to do this. And my whole job every day was to take pictures. So I would just drive park to park to park across the country for years and years and photograph everything, and ended up doing this book. And in the meantime, traveled for like a month at a time. I would break from there and go up to Papua New Guinea because all these amazing hill tribes and things, and with a friend that I met in Australia. And we'd go up there and go on these incredible adventures and looking at amazing cultures that, you know, it was like walking into villages that had been the same for 40,000 years. So to answer the question, I mean, that's really where I became. It's like I was doing it every single day. I was honing the craft every single day. I was thinking every single day about what an image is, what it takes to create an image that's going to say something to people. So, yeah. And then when I came back to the United States, I had thousands of images from those years and of work that no one else basically on the planet had. So it was a goldmine for publishers. And like I said, Australia was really being put on the map during the 1980s. It became a place people wanted to go. And so all of a sudden, you had a lot of people who wanted access to pictures of that place. And so I was fortunate.
Was there a time where something just really clicked for you or just really opened your mind to something new?
I got landed a great opportunity by talking my way into the situation where I got to go to a place called Groot Islet, and they were having a corroboree, which was a gathering of all these Aboriginal tribes across Australia to have a big singing dancing festival called a corroboree. And it was the first one that I think had occurred in 17 years. And the adults had decided to do this because they were worried about the youth not understanding the value of corroboree and singing and the culture and all of that. So this was a way to invest the youth. And I got to be there. I was one of only 4 white people that were on Groot Island. And we were there with about 1,700 Aborigines, Australian Aborigines. It was fascinating to be there and be accepted as just I belonged, you know. I wasn't looked at necessarily as an outsider. I was just like, because I had been vetted by the 2 directors of the foundation that was part of hosting the whole corroboree. It was like, if you're here, you're part of us. And so I just got complete access to people, and they would talk to me, and they would take me in their old, you know, pickups collecting bark and things that they were going to use in doing costumes and stuff. And it was just to see how they used the land and to see how they, as human beings, how they were seamlessly part of this planet. And then to go to Papua New Guinea and then be even more immersed in people who were part of this planet, who their every single day living and survival was what they collected from the forest, what they grew in their gardens. They built their huts out of the stuff they collected from the forest. There wasn't this environment in nature out there. You know, there wasn't a word for environment. There wasn't a word for nature. And we weren't trying to do something with it or to it. It was just seamless. I think that had a really profound impact on me. So this idea of being a photographer and what it meant and the power to communicate with it, and then being immersed into these cultures, made me really start rethinking about how I was going to tell stories and how I was going to, my visuals would talk about that seamlessness.
So as you were taking these great photographs, selling them to other people who then did who knows what with them, what was your vision for the value of these to the world? How did you think people would interpret them? What benefit or what value would they achieve?
You know, I'm not sure that I always immediately thought about it. I mean, I was on my own adventure, partly. I'm my late 20s, early 30s, single, roaming the planet. After coming back from Australia and Papua New Guinea, I ended up living in the Amazon for a year, going all the way down the river and out and seeing that place. And then shortly after that, I was off to Africa. And it was to see all the storybook creatures, you know, that you grow up with, you know, lions and giraffes and hippopotamus and gorillas and chimpanzees and whatever. And so I just wanted to photograph them as a wildlife photographer. Like so many nature photographers, wildlife photographers at the time, I was often trying to capture this almost clinical, what we would call then Sierra Club postcard look of nature. Like it was, I was falling back on looking at the world through my white lens, my Western white lens, which was nature is out there. And I sometimes got caught up in that because that's what everybody wanted to buy. Those people you were talking about who wanted those for books and magazines and whatever, they wanted that kind of clinical nature. And so I was modifying everything I did so that you could sell or license the work to them to use in their things. So you got paid. And I got paid incredibly well for a chunk of my life. Probably one of the top paid photographers on the planet. And you're making a lot of money. You're traveling all over the planet and you want to keep doing this. You know, it's fun. I racked up gazillions of air miles, you know, running back and forth to Africa and places. But it was also there where, you know, it slapped me right in the face as to what I was doing and to make me question the images I was creating and why I was creating them.
Do you think the issues you were becoming aware of, the thoughts you were having about, you know, the big picture in front of you were coming through in your photographs?
I don't think so. I mean, I would see editors and I would see scientists and researchers. There was one scientist at World Wildlife Fund who I'd started doing a lot of work for World Wildlife Fund, and I was sort of the chief person running around the planet for them at the time. And this is in the early 1990s. And I was in his office and he was putting together, like a PowerPoint or slideshow kind of thing that he was going to show on Capitol Hill at Congress to talk about environmental issues that were happening. And he said to me, I can always, even without seeing a name on there, I can always tell which ones are yours. Your images, if the animal is looking at me, it feels as though I'm looking right at the animal. The animal's looking into my soul and I'm looking right back at it. He said, there's some way that you photograph that seems to capture that connection. And the other thing is when I see one of your images of an animal in a landscape, I feel like I know where it lives. I have a strong sense of place. So there were people like Eric who would express that. But I think for the most part, and this was frustrating, but I think for the most part, most people just saw them as pretty pictures.
One of the first outings I ever made with you was back in, must have been the 1990s, and went out with you on one of your shoots. Here in Oregon, you were working on a piece for BBC Wildlife about rainforests. You were shooting temperate rainforests, which I had never heard that term. I didn't know we had rainforests here, frankly. And had my eyes opened a little bit by that.
I come back from the Amazon and I was seeing this insane destruction. You know, in 1990, we'd had or 92, I guess, we'd had the Rio summit and the world came together because the burning of the Amazon, and it was on the front of, you know, magazines like Time Magazine and, you know, New York Times newspaper, and everybody had it, you know, the loss of the Amazon. Unfortunately, here we are 3 decades later, we're still dealing with that. We haven't wised up, those Homo sapiens, the wise men that we are. I saw that destruction going on there, and I came back to the Pacific Northwest in the U.S. here, and, you know, everything from Northern California, Oregon, Washington, all the way up through British Columbia, Canada, to Southeast Alaska, and the same thing was going on. Basically, in the last 200 years, they cut 95%+ of all the big old growth forests that were here, and that's the same thing that was happening in the Amazon. And so, that story that we did together back then was about that very thing, like this rainforest that we have and how it's no different and our needs are no different. And so as, you know, a photographer, my goal was, how do I communicate that? You know, how do I create images that talk about this forest, but also talk about the need humans have? Our needs are no different than the people in Brazil or the people in the Congo Basin. In their want to cut that forest and their want to have a better life and their want to have, you know, a satellite dish on the top of their hut or house so that they can watch the World Cup soccer match going on. You know, the needs are all the same.
Well, you started out what I would call a wildlife photographer or nature photographer. You probably did your best to keep people out of the shots. And somewhere in there, you flipped, I think. Now, a whole lot of what you do, maybe even most of it, we see photos and video with people walking through them. What happened? What changed?
Apes changed it, actually. So I guess we come full circle here. It was late 1980s, 89 or something like that. I'd come back from Australia, and then, like I said, I went off other places, Africa being a main one, and to photograph there. And while I was there, a friend mentioned, he said, would you be interested in photographing chimpanzees? And I said, yeah, sure. Not so much chimpanzees from I was, you know, completely fascinated and compelled to photograph great apes. But it was just, here's another species in Africa and it'd be cool to photograph him. He goes, well, I was a grad student at Gombe where Jane Goodall does her research. He said, I can send her a message and see if it'd be okay if you came there and took some pictures of chimps. And he did. You know, things took a little time because that was pre-email and all of that. So it was letters and things. But I ended up at Gombe over the next few years there three times. And all three times I was there while Jane was there, I photographed chimps, and it wasn't like, oh my God, I'm there with Jane Goodall. And, you know, it wasn't this like earth shattering event. It was just like, yeah, I'm a photographer and they're chimps and I want to photograph them. And she's really cool. I wish I'd approached it a little differently now. I would have probably spent a little more time filming and documenting her at that time and not just chimps. But I was working there, and it was on the third visit, she and I were sitting on the beach at Lake Tanganyika one evening, and she said, you know, you should really get up and photograph mountain gorillas. Diane Fossey had been murdered a few years before that, and things were really out of control. And at that point, you know, there was only thought to be maybe 220 to 250 mountain gorillas surviving. And she said, I think in 5 years, they're going to be gone. And she said, these chimps will be here. You know, you should go up there and be photographing them because I don't think they will be here. It was the first time I was sort of hit with this idea of a species disappearing and extinction. And so immediately left Gombe, got on a boat, went up the lake, crossed over through Burundi and into Rwanda, and went up, just naively thought, oh, I'll just go photograph gorillas. Well, fortunately for me at the time, there was really nobody in charge, and the government didn't really care about gorillas at that point, and there was no big tourism thing or anything. So I went up there, and I ended up making multiple trips over the next 4-ish years to photograph gorillas, and just would sit there all day long, go up with the trackers. I mean, didn't pay permits or fees or anything. There wasn't a national park. There was a national park on paper, but there wasn't a national park as in guards standing there and preventing you from going up. Towards the end of it, in about 1993, 94, there became a little bit of a fledgling tourism business of ecotourism, you know, hardy souls who would make it to Rwanda. And there'd be a few armed people who would take them up to see the gorillas. But basically, there was, I would spend hours photographing them. And it was during that time that, and this really gets to the heart of your question, I think, in 1994, I left a couple months before the genocide. And I went back across to where I was normally based in Nairobi, Kenya. And it was during the time I was there that the genocide occurred. You know, in 100 days, nearly a million people were murdered. And in some cases, really brutally. I was really stunned and shocked that I had been, for the last 4 years, sitting in these mountains, photographing gorillas, oblivious to the undercurrent of frustration, hatred that was building in the country and was there between these groups of people that were right there, right in front of me. You know, whenever I would come and go, you don't just fly into the country, land, and instantly you're in the mountains where the gorillas are. You know, you have to organize a vehicle, you have to organize your supplies, and you have to then travel for several hours to get up to then called Ruwengeri, now it's called Musanze, and then make your way up to where the boundary of the park is, and then hire porters and haul all your stuff up. So it's a multi-day process, and you're encountering human beings the whole time. And the fact that I could do that and be so oblivious to this crisis, potential, this impending crisis of humanity, I sat there in Nairobi and like, how could I be so blind? I went away from that. I didn't go back to Rwanda for many, many, many years. I couldn't because I lost a lot of friends and my people who were my porters and that I worked with. But I came out of that and I had to tell stories that were more connected. That was the turning point for me. It was like, I didn't want to take pictures of pretty animals anymore. I wanted to take pictures. Like, how are we all connected? What's happening on this planet? And so for the next several years, I became much more what I would, I guess, call an environmental photojournalist. My passion was to still incorporate wildlife, but incorporated it. There had to be people in the story. It had to be more holistic.
Well, knowing what you know, now, thinking like you do, having seen all this, pondered a lot about it, what is your role in all of this now? What is your work?
You know, we have these four focal areas around the world. We work with Globio, and we have partners on the ground in those areas across Equatorial Africa and Borneo, where great apes live. And our role is to be the communication eyes and ears for them. How do we communicate their message, the work they're trying to do? And so communication really is at the heart of who and what we are and what I am. I mean, this organization, I founded it 20 years ago, and it's, you know, it's a reflection of who I am and what I think about and what's important. But how we communicate, how I communicate as a photographer, you know, back in the early 90s when I was photographing chimps and gorillas for the first time, the result of that work was magazine articles or a big coffee table book, you know, portfolio book that would end up there. I would never think of those things for the most part now. I mean, because the world shifted, many people don't look at magazines and don't look at big books. They're gorgeous. They're lovely. But that's not the way that a lot of people communicate. You know, they communicate through social media. They communicate through streaming, you know, video sources. They podcasts like we're talking right now. You know, they sit in their car for the next 2 hours driving somewhere and listening to this conversation. And so as communicators, how do we create content that can be utilized in those channels of communication to reach the greatest number of people, with the goal, going back to, you know, why this is called Talking Apes, is to get people to understand that there are five great apes on this planet and hear the things that they need. You know, there was a scientist that said to me in the Congo, he said, great apes are like canaries in the coal mine, which is an old saying, you know, but canaries in the coal mine, they'd take canaries down in there, the coal miners. And if the canaries started having issues, something was wrong with the air and it was time to get out of the coal mine. Well, great apes need many of the same things that we need on this planet in terms of resources. And if we just pay attention, as they diminish on this planet, says a lot about where they live and what's happening to this planet. We've gone from over a million great apes of bonobos, chimpanzees, and gorillas across equatorial Africa just a century ago to now less than a few hundred thousand.
But it seems that just providing people with information doesn't always do much. I mean, we've got so much information. We have access to everything, really, these days. But is that a call to action? Does that get anything done?
Awareness, understanding, and action. All too often in the conservation fields and environmental fields, I think we have asked people to, with very little awareness about something, jump to the action piece. You need to do this. You must do this. The planet's dying. You have to stop driving your car or, you know, eat less beef or whatever. It's like, do the action. The whole time, they don't have the awareness and understanding of why you're asking them to do that. And so what we try to do is create that space for awareness with the content that we're creating and things like that. I mean, this podcast is exactly that. It's an opportunity to create awareness about things in conversation with people who know so much more than I do about zoonotic disease, about, you know, food security, about apes. I mean, we've had some amazing people on that talk about behavioral stuff that chimps do or gorillas do that just, it blows me away. And that's what I think brings about these, what I like to say is, you know, the light bulb moments, the aha moment. If we can do that, it creates those moments where people they're listening and they may not have it right then, but then an hour or two later or a day later, or they're driving somewhere else, and all of a sudden they're thinking about a conversation we've had, and they go, oh my God, that aha moment strikes, and they get excited about thinking about the world in a different way. So whether it's Talking Apes, whether it's our Apes Like Us channel, it's our film documentaries, whatever it happens to be, is to create that opportunity. And in the same way, try to work with our partners on the ground so that they can create that same kind of opportunity locally with people that they work with, so that those aha moments are authentic and indigenous to that place, because then they will have value and meaning to those people, whether they're in Rwanda or they're in Congo or Sierra Leone or Borneo or, you know, wherever. So that's how we change it. That's it. So I feel like my job is as a communicator to create awareness and the opportunity for understanding, but in between there, create also a fertile place for that aha moment to happen. That's, to me, has the opportunity to be transformational and create the kind of change that we know needs to happen.
You work with a lot of people involved in particular projects. And you have kind of a unique perspective, I think, because you are familiar with so many of them. You have a perspective on things, an overall perspective, that a lot of these really committed, wonderful, and often brilliant folks may not have, because they're so down on the ground in the trenches doing the work. How do they stay positive in the face of so much adversity all the time from seemingly every direction? For that matter, how do you stay positive, knowing about so many things that need fixing?
What I realized very quickly is that there wasn't necessarily very many people taking this umbrella approach to this, looking at how do all these silos that we're working in connect? How does the work that you're doing in one place in Cameroon connect to the work that someone's doing in one place in Borneo, or on one species, or on one group? And what were the connections? And how could we understand those connections better and utilize those connections to maybe alter what we're doing on this planet? To answer your question about how do I stay positive, it's because I see the connections. And I think when you start seeing the connections, you get excited because you realize we don't have to solve a problem here and we don't have to solve a problem here. I think too much of what goes on feels like a million problems that we have to solve. One of the very first board members that we had at Globio was an economist from the University of Oregon. One day after a board meeting, we went out, we were having a beer, and he said, you know, the challenge you have in explaining what you're trying to do and connecting people is that the thing that you're looking at is like an amoeba. And if anybody has ever seen an amoeba under a microscope, it's this thing that doesn't have a clear shape to it. It's constantly on the move, and so it's kind of oozing and, you know, moving around all the time. The borders of it change constantly. What we're trying to do is look at all of these things as like a giant amoeba. And it's too big for us to see as an individual. It's too big for me to see or you to see. So what we have to do is we have to make enough people aware of it so that we can get all these people lined up around the perimeter of this thing. Thousands of people. And all at one time, we yell what we see. We see a fraction of this giant amoeba, and we all yell out what it is we see. And then we collectively take all of that. And for that moment in time, there's a vision of what the amoeba is. And that's kind of what I feel like this is. We have to engage, because it's all connected, we have to engage enough people in being interested to know what it looks like that they will tell us. All those little silos will tell us simultaneously what they're seeing in the world, and we can build a collective picture of the world and what it looks like. Just like when we were looking down at the ground at those tiny little things and there's this big panoramic view, we need somebody to look at the panoramic view and tell us what they're seeing, and we need other people to be looking at the tiny things. We can't do it all at once, but we have to trust one another's vision and take that vision and marry them all together. And that's that connectedness, that those aha moments. We marry them all together into a collective aha, and all of a sudden, we're optimistic about making change. We're optimistic about what we can do on this planet. You know, Jane Goodall said to me, sitting on the beach one evening, she said, if I hadn't studied chimps, I would have studied human beings, but I don't think they would have let me sit in the corner of their living room with a notepad and take notes on their behavior. But she said, human beings are so fascinated. We have this incredible brain. We're so capable of being so destructive, so violent, so aggressive, but at the same time, we can do the most incredibly sensitive things. We can be so kind. We can think up the most amazing inventions in the world. What a marvelous creature. That's the optimism. When we look at that better side of ourselves, what amazing creatures we are. You have to trust that somewhere there's a kernel in all of us that's filled with kindness and optimism and hope, and that will break through. Doesn't mean there aren't mean people in the world. Doesn't mean there aren't selfish people in the world, but collectively, all those people standing around that amoeba, you trust that they have hope and they have kindness and optimism, and they're going to yell it out, and we'll make a difference.
You know, Jerry, but this is a wonderful thing you're doing here, and I've enjoyed our visit, and I think it's about time for me to give your show back to you. Thank you very much. Best wishes in all endeavors.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate you taking the time to have this conversation. And this show means a lot because it reaches a lot of people. And selfishly, I get to talk to a lot of amazing people. And there's so much behind you and that we didn't even share with people on this podcast. But it's my life has been filled with a lot of truly amazing people. And there's many more to come.
It was truly a special treat to share the microphone with my friend, the incredibly talented Eric Kane. Eric's generosity and patience knows no limits, and I have learned so much about the craft of storytelling from Eric over the years. And on this episode, thanks, Eric, for the questions and for all the post-production help. You've been listening to Talking Apes, where each episode we explore the world of apes with experts from research to outreach, with passionate primate people and conservationists from around the world. Our guests are at the forefront of news about apes like us. Check out our list of upcoming guests in 2023, as well as a catalog of previous episodes on our Talking Apes website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes, one word, .org, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. If you have any questions for us here at Talking Apes, you can always email us at media@talkingapes.org. I'd like to thank Talking Apes assistant producer, Demelza Bond, for all of her work behind the scenes this past year, and to our lead researcher, new on board this year, Megan Lewandowski. I would like to say a special thanks to all those who have supported us with donations. The Talking Apes podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Please consider supporting Talking Apes with your tax-deductible donation. You can also become a valued Patreon subscriber, where you will have access to special features, sneak previews, and behind-the-scenes interviews. All those links at talkingapes.org. And finally, as we close out the year, I would like to especially thank all those who work tirelessly every day to rescue and protect wild great apes. We hope through Talking Apes we can add a stronger voice to everything you do. I'm Jerry Ellis. Happy and peace-filled 2023 to everyone. Thanks for listening to Talking Apes.